Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Yuri Herrera, whose new book is Kingdom Cons. We'll also hear from Paige Bowers, who's the author of The General's Niece, the little-known de Gaulle who fought to free occupied France. Tulane professor Yuri Herrera has explored the drug and crime culture of his native Mexico in two previous novels, Signs Preceding the End of the World and Transmigration of Bodies. Now in a new book, Kingdom Cons, he gives us a rich look at the society a drug lord creates with his followers and surroundings. It is spellbinding. Yuri Herrera, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me here again. I'm really happy to be here.
Always a pleasure. Now, this is a relatively short book, as all your books are, and it reads as if it's written in that old, old form of the fairy tale. You're literally constructing a kingdom here.
Yeah, it has a little bit of that. I wanted it to play with the idea of a song, but also with the idea of a fable. You know, and the idea of oral history, how it is transmitted. So this is the story of an artist and his relationship with a really powerful man. And this powerful man happens to be a criminal. So for me, it's a little bit the story of how the artist ends up acknowledging his own power and discovering that he doesn't owe his powers or his virtue to this other powerful man.
And even though this is your third book published in the United States, this is the first book you wrote, right?
Yes, it was published in Mexico in 2004. I won an award with it, Premio Binacional de Novela Fronteriza, like something like Border Novel Binational Prize. And in the first 4 years, it didn't receive much attention, but in 2008, it was published in Spain, and it started receiving a lot more attention. And afterwards is when the translations started.
So finally, we get your first book. I love that. Now, we see so much of this story through the eyes of a character who begins as Lobo, a singer who boxes down each night on the street. I love that expression, boxes down. And he's so fascinating. You write about the way his parents have left him behind and emigrated, and they've left him behind with just an accordion to make his way in the cantinas. And this, I thought, was so interesting. You write, it was there he learned that while boleros can get by with a sweet face, corridos require bravado and acting out the story as you sing. He also learned the following truths: life is a matter of time and hardship. There's a God who says, deal with it, because this is the way it is, and perhaps most important, steer clear of a man about to vomit. That's hard word truths. But I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the difference between a bolero and a corrido.
Well, a bolero is a romantic song. It's about a certain period in Latin America. You know, most countries in Latin America claim that they invented the boleros. I actually think they were invented in Cuba, and they had their golden age in Mexico, and then it happened in a lot of other countries. Usually you have three singers, but also sometimes it's just one singer. And it's just a love song, usually. Mm-hmm. They are songs of painful love. Whereas the corridos, what they do, the corridos, is they tell stories. And they tell stories that usually are not in the news. So since the Mexican Revolution in Mexico, corridos have been this kind of parallel way of learning certain truths, certain pieces of information. And in the last decades, there has been a lot of corridos about the war on drugs. A lot of people think that they are only about praising drug lords, but it's not like that. Sometimes they are criticizing drug lords. Sometimes they are about the victims of the war. Sometimes they are songs criticizing the government. So it's a universe in itself. It's really interesting.
I thought that was fascinating. Now, after Lobo, the artist, is seen by the king, he becomes part of his court, part of his kingdom. Describe that process.
Well, he meets this guy. He's Lobo. It's a really poor singer. He lives on the streets. He just does this to survive. And suddenly he meets this very powerful guy who gives him some respect. So the moment he receives this respect from this powerful guy, he decides that he wants to be part of his entourage. So he goes to the place where he lives, that is described, because we are seeing the novel through his eyes, that is described as a palace, you know. And he gets in there and he offers his services and he becomes part of the court, as to say. So this, at the beginning, is just something really luminous, is something that is very surprising for him. And he will eventually have a nuanced perspective on this. He will start seeing all the dark spots on this kingdom.
And talk about some of the people who make up this court around the king, the journalist, the traitor, the manager, the witch. I especially liked the witch.
Well, all the people in this small kingdom define themselves in relation to how they conserve the king. That's why most of the characters don't have names, but they just have the name of the job they are supposed to do. So this is something that helps me to create some tension, because in this place, everyone has a specific task. If you don't fulfill that task, somehow you become suspicious. So this is part of the tension between the artist, which is the name that he receives, the singer, and the king, as he is discovering new things about this person, as he's discovering new things about the business surrounding this person, he eventually will have to do some things that are not what are expected from him.
And there is also an incredible love story in this book, too, of course, as there is in most fairy tales.
Yeah, of course. Well, he falls in love with a woman that is also part of this court, but she's also a rebel. And the thing with the women in this novel is that they are all playing in a world with rules that were made by men and for men. So they are apparently subservient. They are apparently submissive. But this is also one of the things that he is about to discover, that women have their own ideas and have their own will, and they are not just expecting what the men tell them to do.
Oh, yes. I mean, everyone has to discover that eventually.
Yeah.
Now, you seem to me to do something new with this subject every time you write about it. Do you see this as an inexhaustible line of inquiry for you?
Well, the thing is this. After I published this book, I have been called narco-writer or narco-narrator, things like that, even though I never, not one single time in the whole book, use the words drugs or drug trafficking,
right,
or dealer or any drug-related word. Mm-hmm. And the purpose for this was that I try to find new ways to talk about the topics that we think that we already understood, because this is one of the things that literature can do, that it can throw light on things that we just got used to see under a same light. So for me, it's not so much about discovering new issues or discovering new topics as much as taking a new look at things that we see every day and we are just used to take them for granted, or that we think that we understand how they work. So social conflicts and violence, we may think that we understand them, but there's a lot more underneath, you know. This is something that can be said about Mexico, but also it's something that can be said about the United States, specifically about New Orleans, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like all the stories that are hidden, all the different motives and reasons behind the violence. You
know? And they illuminate such great social currents that are sweeping through our society today. It's just an amazing thing to do. And the relationship between the king and the artist will always be fraught, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always something, some anxiety there, you know.
Yes.
Who has the power, who has to obey, to what extent your freedom is not messing with your sponsor.
So what is it like for you to have these books published out of order? I mean, in Kingdom Cons, you're going back to a book you wrote, your first book.
Yes.
2004, a while back. So did you work on it again? Did you re-edit it? Did you see things in it you liked or things you wanted to change? What was the process?
I never change things in old books. I think they already have a life of their own. And this book specifically has given me so many things that I'm just respecting it as it is. Of course, there are things that I would change now. Some things that have to do with style, some things that have to do with what a couple of characters, with the way that the plot develops, maybe some things in the ending. But you can't be in control all the time. And the books find their own readers. And this is a book that struggled the first years, but eventually find its own readers. The only thing that I work again is explaining what I try to do to the translators. It has been translated already to, I'm not sure, 7 languages, I think, maybe 8. So I have to be aware of certain things that I only did by following my intuition at the moment. And now I have to articulate it in a different way so that the translators understand exactly what I was trying to do. You know, so that is an interesting thing. It's a sort of rewriting in a language that you don't manage, that you don't dominate really.
Now, you're very close to your English translator, Lisa Dillman. Do you work that closely with translators in other languages?
No. I think, well, Lisa and I are really good friends. We are really good collaborators, and I always consider translators as co-authors based on my experience with Lisa, in which we discuss every single detail, and we discuss the musicality of the text, and we discuss the different meanings and the nuances. I have had similar relationships with a translator into German and translator into Portuguese, but in some cases I have never heard from the translator. I just learned that the book was translated into Norwegian and
they
didn't contact me, so I have no idea how that's going to sound, but I just trust them. You know, they know the readership much better than me.
Well, it's so interesting because it's about such terrible things, but it's so beautiful to read. The language is just exquisite.
Yeah, you know, sometimes when you talk about this kind of topics, you receive this criticism that you're not supposed to aestheticize violence.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, every time you speak about violence, you are already aestheticizing because you are choosing certain words and not other words. So they are sounding in a certain way. For me, style is very important because there is ethics in how you choose words.
Right.
There is politics in how you choose words. And also, when you're talking about these things, it's important to stay away from what some mainstream media is doing all the time, which is pornography of violence.
That's right.
What they call realism or objectivity, it's just a really cruel, unsympathetic look at the victims, you know?
Right. Well, you've created your own language, your own vernacular for this, and it is astonishing and exquisite and propels the reader through the book, I think. Oh, so thanks.
Thanks to you.
We've been talking with Yuri Herrera, whose new book is Kingdom Cons. You can meet him Tuesday, June 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Yuri, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paige Bowers is a Baton Rouge-based journalist who has turned her love of France into a writing path. Her new book, The General's Niece, The Little-Known de Gaulle Who Fought to Free Occupied France, tells the story of Geneviève de Gaulle and her work in the French Resistance during World War II. Paige also teaches continuing education classes in French history and culture at Louisiana State University. Paige joins us from the studios of WRKF in Baton Rouge. Paige Bowers, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, so how did you first become interested in Geneviève de Gaulle?
It's a really strange story, actually. I went back to graduate school much later in life, and I had originally studied 19th century French history, which has absolutely nothing to do with World War II, I guess. So my advisor told me what you really need to do is read General de Gaulle's war memoirs. And when you're in graduate school, you read kind of in desperation because you have about at least 1,000 pages to read a week on top of other things. So when I cracked open volume one, I went right past the dedication page. He dedicated it to Geneviève, his brave niece. And I went right into the body of the work without thinking too deeply about who she was and why he might have dedicated the book to her, which is a sad, sad commentary on women's history. But I have to tell you, that's what I did. And then a couple of years later, when I was out of graduate school and preparing to teach a class at LSU, I came across a news story that said this Genevieve, to whom he dedicated these memoirs, would be interred in the Pantheon, which is a grand mausoleum in Paris, which is full of great French historical figures. So I began looking into her life and her times and her contributions, not only to the wartime effort, but also to the post-war. She was not only a very brave young woman during World War II, but after the war, she was every bit of a substantial public figure in France after the war. Her contributions to women and the poor were really remarkable. So that's how it got started. Yeah.
Well, you begin the book with this absolutely captivating description of meeting some women who knew her and worked with her.
Yes, that was one of the most magnificent afternoons of my life. Both of these women, one of them was Anis Postel-Vinet, who gathered intelligence for the Allies, and the other was Michelle Moyaniel. She helped down fighter pilots, and she entered the resistance at age 14. It was really remarkable. So I was able to meet them through Genevieve's daughter, Isabelle Gagini. She first put me in touch with Michelle Moyaniel. And Michelle Moyaniel said, I won't sit down with you unless Anis Postel-Vinet is there. And I said, well, Madame Gagini did not give me her phone number. She goes, well, here's her phone number. Just tell Anis that Isabelle gave it to you. And I said, wait. I can't do that. That's dishonest. I came here. I'm trying to get her trust. And I'm trying to be honest about it. Can I please call her to arrange this? I see it in the prologue. There's a lot of begging that was going on over the course of 48 hours. Trying to sit down with this woman who I knew was a very close part of Genevieve's circle. They met in the concentration camp, survived that concentration camp, and were lifelong friends after that. But to sit down with these two women who I had read about, to see them in the flesh and to hear their memories of wartime France was such a special treat for me. And it really kind of formed some of the richer anecdotes. Actually, a lot of the anecdotes are really rich, but some of the really special anecdotes in the book came from this afternoon.
Oh, I can tell. And along the way, you paint such an interesting portrait of the entire de Gaulle family.
Yes, and that was a little trickier to do. They are private, but there are certain things that have been written about them that you can draw from. There's memoirs that have been written. Obviously, General de Gaulle wrote his memoirs, but, you know, I was really interested in the women. Genevieve's aunt, Agnès, wrote a really lovely memoir of her life growing up de Gaulle, but then also how she got into the resistance. And her stories overlap with her brother's, obviously, but also her niece's, who became such a heroine. So you draw from these testimonies, you draw from the interviews that you can get. I mean, I did speak at length with Genevieve's daughter. And you put these pieces together in what way you can. You know, it was a tricky balance, but, you know, I wasn't trying to write a comprehensive history of World War II. I was trying to write a little jewel box of a book about this family, and specifically this young girl, how they responded to what was going on around them, the choices they made.
Right.
You know?
And it was a time when having a well-known name like de Gaulle was truly a double-edged sword.
And that's funny because later in life, Genevieve was asked, you know, it was either, did you enjoy being de Gaulle or what was it like to be de Gaulle? I forget the specific question, but her answer was very telling. She said, you know, on the one hand, it's very difficult to be a de Gaulle, you know, because at various points in time, her uncle sparked the ire of the French people with some of his decisions. They didn't always agree with them. And so that kind of spilled over toward the whole entire family. But at other times, she said, being a de Gaulle was a great comfort. It was a great honor, you know, because of what the family stood for.
So. It must have been very difficult for you to go back and write those passages about her time in Ravensbrück.
Oh, my. Yes. There was a lot of hard reading about that section. have to be honest, I wrote that section of the book first because there was such a tremendous amount of testimony about it, you know, of the pictures that can be found. Some of them are very disturbing. There were sketches that some of the prisoners did while they were in the camp, and they concealed them. But the testimony that they had was really obviously horrible. But I wanted to try to paint the most faithful vision of what happened there. And so you had to do that hard reading mm-hmm. to get that middle section that I wrote.
And one of the things that's so amazing about her was that she never stopped. You know, her life after the war was one of such dedication to social justice. And she was one of those women who did it all. She had a strong family. She had mm-hmm. a committed professional life. She just never stopped.
She absolutely could have said, you know what, I've been through some really hard things the past couple of years. I just want to raise my family and be done with it. But that wasn't the way she was raised, and that wasn't the sort of woman that she became. Because, you know, she was raised in this family to embrace a certain idea of France, to respect family, to embrace history and words and language and culture. She was a very cultured woman. But, you know, there was no quit in her. There was absolutely no quit in her. So at the end of the war, when she looked around her and she saw that so many of the women that she had been imprisoned with at Ravensbrück, you know, when she saw the problems that they would have, the grief health issues, you know, they came back to France. Many of them lost their husbands. They lost their homes. At the time, women had not had the right to vote or open bank accounts or so forth until after the war was over. So they weren't really accustomed to navigating this huge French bureaucracy at all. First of all, she went out, even in her devastated health, to go talk about what she had just endured. She used those talks to raise money that would set up these rest homes and free health care for the women that she had met in the camps. So it started there. And there were other women trying to help women after the war. Genevieve met with one of these groups, and they actually banded together to make a bigger group that could offer women job training, give them clothes, give them support. You know, once a week they met over tea at this headquarters that they built together to just talk about what they had endured. Because one of the things they said was, you know, we came back to France and we felt like not many people understood what we had been through. And not many people wanted to hear about what we had been through because the war was over and they wanted to move on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, after what they had endured, they still were living with these thoughts, these memories, these nightmares, and they needed to find their support somewhere. So she found a way of putting that together for women who had endured what she had. And the group lasted until her death in 2002. That was the thing that was really remarkable about it. A lot of them had put their lives back together, but they still saw value in having this bond with each other. And then once they got their lives back together, being kind of like this voice of witness for the country, this moral conscience for the country, saying, we can't go back to this. And these are the things that we need to stand for. So I thought that was fascinating.
Now, one of the things that makes this book such a pleasure to read is that it is very passionately written. You obviously admire her. That admiration comes mm-hmm. through on every page. And to be a biographer, to spend so much time with a subject, you have to fall a little in love with them.
Oh, sure.
So talk a bit about what drew you to her and what lessons she's taught you that you can carry forward into your own life.
You know, I like the idea of a young woman who did not feel that she was too small or too female, not enough of a warrior. Like she said, I was not going to be a person that was going to pick up a gun to do something for my country. You know, she was going to find another way to make a contribution. You know, she never thought twice about it. She just thought, you know, this is wrong. I need to do something. And that's exactly what she did, even when, you know, her life was at risk every step of the way. I liked her spunk. I mean, I'm a pretty bookish woman myself. I liked that there was this bookish young heroine who wanted to make a difference. her uncle casts this formidable shadow. You know, he's this grand figure in France. I liked the idea of bringing out this equally compelling de Gaulle from his shadow to kind of let her stand alone in her own right as a fascinating figure. So I wanted to share that story as well.
We've been talking with Baton Rouge writer Paige Bowers, whose new book is The General's Niece, the little-known de Gaulle who fought to free occupied France. Paige, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Yuri Herrera, signs Kingdom Cons, Tuesday, June 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tom McDermott plays music and signs his book, Five Lines, No Waiting, Limericks and Sketches, Tuesday, June 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The New Orleans Museum of Art Book Club discusses Art Lover, a biography of Peggy Guggenheim by Anton Gill, Wednesday, June 21st from 1:30 to 3, and again Friday, June 23rd from 11:30 to 1 in the NoMA Library. The selection for July will be Stories of Art and Artists by Diana Secker-Tesdell. Contact librarian Sheila Cork at 504-658-4117 or scork@noma.org for information about joining this book club. The third annual Jefferson Parish Library Mystery Readers and Writers Literary Festival takes place Saturday, June 24th at 9:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. It's all free. Here's the schedule. New York Times bestselling author Erica Spindler kicks things off at 9:30 with a keynote address, followed by author, prosecutor Sal Perricone talking about the wheels of justice at 10:30. Former police officer and attorney Jeff Blue talks about high-speed car chases at noon, followed by a break for lunch. John McCarthy picks things up at 2, discussing Hard Role, a paramedic's perspective of life and death in New Orleans, followed by a masterclass on pacing by best-selling author Bill Lofelm at 3:30. Lauren Albright signs her young adult novel Exit Strategy, Saturday, June 20th at 2 at Octavia Books. Tanisha Jones discusses and signs her book, Mark of the Fallen, a fallen novel, Sunday, June 25th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. There will be a special reading and memorial service to honor the poet Danny Kerwick, who died May 30th. That takes place Sunday, June 25th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Carl Levin discusses and signs From Homefront to Battlefront, an Ohio teenager in World War II, Tuesday, June 27th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Wednesday, June 28th from 5 to 7:30 at the National World War II Museum. Courtney Sloan, author of Science and Men, and J.P. Sloan, author of The Curse Mandate, Dark Choir No. 3, discuss and sign their work Tuesday, June 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And remember, all our area libraries have special summer reading programs going on, not just for young readers, but readers of all ages. Check out your branch library for more information. And coming up, the Letters Read series, curated by stationer Nancy Sharon Collins, features performances of the Herman and Grima family letters, Thursday, June 29th from 6:30 to 8 at the Herman Grima House, 820 St. Louis Street. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.